Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben. Hi, everyone.
Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number, it's 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. And we'll get straight into it with what to see in the sky. A few things happening this week, John, despite the stretch, grand stretch in the evenings, there are a few things happening. Do we start with meteors or planets, perhaps?
We go planets, because I was out at the early hours of the morning a couple of nights ago, again, doing these things. So I just step outside, and I was looking at Venus and Jupiter. And the Venus is noticeably brighter, at -3.9. Jupiter is -2. And Jupiter is the one that's virtually overhead, and Venus is over to the west, northwest at the moment. So it's gleaming low at the moment. So it's a fantastic sight to see. And this week, Venus passes the Pleiades cluster, and that's always a lovely pairing as well. It's a conjunction about 3 degrees lower to the left of them. So I better go out and just check that as well. That's on the Thursday of the 23rd of this week. Uranus, I'm going to go in reverse of these. Uranus, 5.8 in Taurus. It's a very, very faint star passing in the background of Venus, and they'll be in conjunction 3/4 of a degree apart. So that might be well worth having a little scout through the sky to see. And the other four, Mercury, Mars, Saturn and Neptune, are very low in the brightening glow of sunrise just at the moment. And you can use binoculars or a telescope at low power, and you might try for them for a few degrees above the horizon, almost due east, about 20 minutes just before sunrise, when you get a good chance to see them. Of course, when the sun comes up, that's it. They sort of disappear. And we went through Venus. We went through the whole lot of them as well. The space station, of course, back in our skies on May the 8th, which is not too far away. And it's going to be through until May the 22nd. And just to keep a note on the diary there. I was out the other night as well, Ben. The thin crescent moon was up as well. A really, really pleasant
sight. I sent some pictures of it with the beautiful earthshine and magic, and with Venus just below it.
Yes, that's
and the Pleiades star cluster also nearby.
Yeah. So magic. And then I was watching it just as the days were going past, as the moon was getting a little bit larger. It's still pretty small in the thumbnail, sort of what I would call the thumbnail, but it's still a very, very pleasant sight to see as well. So that's what to see in the sky just at the moment.
Thank you, John. We get to the meteors in a moment, but first, speaking of the moon, we have a waxing crescent moon, as you alluded to there, John. At the moment, it's at 25% phase. It's not on view at the moment. It has set well. It is on view. What am I saying? Mm-hmm. Yes, but it will set in tomorrow morning around about 3 a.m. and will rise again just after 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. At that stage, it'll be up to a 31% waxing crescent phase as we head towards the first quarter moon, which will be on Friday the 24th. So, we'll get back to that. That's kind of relevant in a way for our little meteor story in a moment. But the sun will rise tomorrow in Dublin, Wednesday 22nd at 6:10 in the morning, 15 minutes earlier than a week ago, and local or solar noon. That's when the sun is at its highest, and due south, that's at 1:23 p.m., which is 2 minutes earlier than a week ago, and the sun will set at 8:38 p.m., which is 13 minutes later than a week ago, and then we have various degrees of twilight until astronomical twilight ends and nighttime begins. officially at 11:06 p.m. And that means tomorrow we'll have 4 minutes exactly more daylight than today, when there will be 14 hours and 28 minutes between sunrise and sunset. So that means, of course, there'll be 28 minutes more daylight tomorrow than we had a week ago. So the moon is not in too bad a position, I suppose, or phase when it comes to looking out for the Lyrid meteors, which peak
tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And just before we get to that, just to note that that very bright object, unless, I mean, if, don't know where you've been if you haven't recognized that bright object in the sky now, but just below that very bright object to the lower left of the moon tomorrow is Jupiter.
Yeah. The moon moved quite quickly to the skies because it was way over with Venus a few nights ago, and now it's over near Jupiter. It's remarkable to see how quickly it goes as well. So we were mentioning the Lyrid meteor shower. They came in to see us on the 16th, and you might have got a few just before, a few after, and tomorrow is the peak. Now, it's the peak here at 2000 GMT. Are we GMT plus one at the
plus
moment?
Plus one at the moment,
plus one, so it's 9 o'clock our time here is the peak, although it's only just getting dark, but we will get a good chance to see these as well. They come in from a star, or the star area called Vega, which is a very recognisable bright star as well. So I'm looking forward to, with a bit of luck, getting a clear night tomorrow evening, just to see if we can spot one or two of those little fellas as well. So you were asking me earlier on, we were just reminding ourselves what and where the comet comes from. And it's one that's known as C1861, presumably discovered in 1861. And G1 Thatcher is what it's the comet is named after. And the shower's radiant indicates the direction from which the meteors strike our Earth's atmosphere. So not a hugely big meteor shower, but still big enough to be able to see it as well. The moon is not quite bright enough really to disturb us too much. So with a bit of luck, we'll get to see a few there as well. It's only 27% lit, by the way. So that's good. So look up, if you don't know where it is, just look up or Google Eyes, as we call it, the star Lyra, or Vega, should I say, and that's where they mostly come in from, although they will come in right and left as well. And they're going to be around until the 25th. So you get a good chance, but again, peaking tomorrow evening, so looking forward to that.
Yes, as you mentioned, the radiant is near Vega, and which, of course, is in Lyra. So they reached they're expecting the maximum peak. It's called a ZHR, or zenith hourly rate, is between 15 and 20 per hour, which is about one every 3 minutes or so. Now, you very rarely see that. You really need to be in a very dark sky. Very clear sky in a very dark area, away from, miles away from any lights, and of course the moon out of sight as well. But certainly well worth looking out for, no doubt.
I love the rogue ones, you know, the one you're looking at. The one you catch just at the corner of your eye, and by the time you've looked around, it's gone. But these things look as if they're landing next door into the garden next
they
door.
They can
they're
do,
about
yeah.
60 miles up or thereabouts, coming into the atmosphere at up to sort of 40,000 miles an hour. But it's remarkable. I love them.
Okay, just back to the planets. On some other point just for you. On Friday of this week, the 24th, Uranus and Venus are 1 degree, less than 1 degree apart. And they'll also be 3.5 degrees from the Pleiades. And next Monday, Venus will be between the Hyades and Pleiades star cluster. So if you're looking Friday, as I mentioned, 24th, a good chance to try and get out and spot Uranus. It should be in your same field of view, which your average 10 by 50 binoculars. You'll see Venus, of course, no problem. But the brightest other object there will be the planet Uranus. And if you have a little telescope, you will know for sure that it's Uranus. Can be greeny type of colour mostly, and you will know that it is because it'll be you should see with even a small telescope that it's a disk and not just a single point of light, which would all the other stars in the sky will be.
Yeah, now I was watching television again in the early hours of the morning the other morning, and every now and again they put a quiz question on this particular channel, and the question was which planet spins clockwise. And I was thinking to myself, I said, is it
Uranus? Which direction? From basically the opposite direction to the, all the others.
Yeah, all the others, exactly. So
I know that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, then it took me a second or so just to get it right. And I had to double check when the answer came on the screen. So it was Venus.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, it is.
Where the day is longer than the year.
Yeah, well, it's really strange. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember hearing that as a kid and thinking, huh? I just couldn't get my head around that one. But yeah, so it takes longer to... Yep. Turn once on its axis than it does to go around the sun.
Not a pleasant place to be, though. That's the only thing.
Oh, no. I was just explaining to somebody, only yesterday it was, that, we're talking about life on planets, and would there be life on Venus? I said, well, unlikely, not life as we know it, Jim, mm-hmm. but as we have covered on this program before about the possibility of life in some parts of the clouds, some microscopic life mm-hmm. where conditions might be a little bit more favorable, but the when you're talking about going to the planets and going to the moon and going to Mars, and what about Venus? And I said, well, the problem with Venus is there's a few problems. Firstly, there's the surface temperature is around about 400 degrees centigrade, so you need to be well protected. And even if you had you went out in good thermals, mm-hmm. it'd still be crushed because the atmosphere is roughly 90 times that on Earth. So you'd be crushed, boiled, melted, and basically an instant if you didn't have the proper protection. I don't know whether such protection exists.
One of the spacecraft that got into the atmosphere and landed was only lasted about 45 minutes.
Before the thing. And then...
It got melted.
They reckon the rain, the sulfuric acid. So,
you imagine the little microbes up there having a little discussion up in the clouds, and they're looking down on the surface and saying, "We're not going down there.
We're not going
down there. Hot, hot, hot. Oh, I'm not very pleasant." So there we go. Just let's slip out a little bit further. Just to Voyager 1. Some news popped in earlier on. They're shutting down, would you believe, the instruments to keep the probe exploring interstellar space. And I was trying to do a bit of calculation before I read it, and it was way back in 2012 when the Voyager 1 left the solar system. It seems like only yesterday.
I would never guess it was 14 years ago.
Yeah, so at this moment in time, it's probably gone around 15 billion miles, if you still work in miles, and it's 24 billion kilometres, if you're a little bit more modern, and you work in kilometres. I still work in miles, because I know exactly what a mile is. It's just...
But you just have to get used to it.
It's like,
transferring over to the euro.
Yeah.
There's no point in trying to convert back to pounds. It's...
Well, that was the great thing about Ireland. It took us about 4 days to get everything out, all the old stuff, and in with the new. Whereas the Italians and French didn't like it at all.
No, for years later, they were still printing in France. The subject now. Yeah. They'd still, at the end of their receipts, where it's euro, they'd also have a little bit at the end saying that it's equivalent to so many French francs.
Yep, still, because people could relate to it. Yeah, so there we go. Just going back to Voyager 1 and 2, both of them are out into interstellar space at the moment. 15-odd billion miles. And hurtling through the space at about 40,000 miles per hour, just a mere 40,000. And they've decided to shut down the experiment sort of thingies, because it has a little... nuclear power system.
Yeah, because it's too far away mm-hmm. from the sun to put for them to put solar panels on it. So they went straight for nuclear power to drive the instruments.
4 watts or something like that. And I don't know how long it's going to last exactly before it decides, but they've still got a fair bit to go. Still beaming back information. And one day it'll just disappear, and then There'll be somebody out there saying, what was that? Where did that come from? Which would be remarkable.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? That'd be extra, brilliant. Some aliens to sell spacecraft isn't
somebody,
boy, and said,
somebody coming across that Tesla car that's up there as well, hurtling around Mars and back. I'd say it's in a bit of a state, needs a bit of an old polish.
Just to respray for sure.
Yeah, well, certainly, yeah, and poor old Starman inside, or whatever his name is. So, yep, arm out the window and everything is absolutely brilliant.
So they shut down this instrument. It's called the Low Energy Charge Particles Experiment, or LECP. They turned it off last Friday, the 17th. Basically, as you mentioned, to shut down or to save some of the energy for some of the other instruments. They decided years ago which instruments they were going to shut down in what order, on the Voyager 1 and the Voyager 2. And the one on the same instrument on the Voyager 2 was shut down in March of last year, I believe. They both had 10 suites of 10 instruments, mm-hmm. both the same on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and they shut them down in a planned order, and now there's only 3 instruments operational on each of the spacecraft. They were launched, as you mentioned, back in 1977, 3 weeks apart. Actually, Voyager 2 was launched 3 weeks yeah. before Voyager 1. Yeah, the other thing, of course, about that, is, as you mentioned, is a very low battery and a very weak signal. It's amazing that they can still pick up the signal mm-hmm. from so far away. I mean, 15 or 24 billion kilometers.
Yeah.
So the antenna has to be pointing in the right direction. And, some of the large radio telescopes on Earth to pick up the signal and then send a message back, which...
It takes to
turn it down, I think it's about one light day away, is it, or something like that?
Something like that.
It's 20 or 24 hours, something like that. So you send the message, it goes at the speed of light, and it takes a whole day to reach the spacecraft.
To reach there, and then a day to get back.
And then the aircraft spacecraft is what it does, and sends a message back saying, yeah, that's done, and that takes a day to get back, traveling at the speed of light.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. Really. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's not a sausage out there. Nothing. No stars, no nothing. Just total blank vacuum of space and minus 200 and near absolute zero, I would imagine.
Just to go back to that very briefly, of course, where does the solar system end? And it's essentially, it is where the... Basically, the outward pressure of the solar wind, mm-hmm. where that is overtaken by inward pressure of the whatever interstellar medium, mm-hmm. the cosmic rays and that type of thing. So it's not like one miniature inside, and it does presumably move back and forth a bit. I think that's what happened to one of them. It was outside, and then it was inside and outside, because mm-hmm. The sun got more active and less active. And so it's like a balloon that kind of expands a little bit and contracts a little bit. But so there's no defining line. It's not as though it was defined to be so many miles out and somebody arbitrarily said, that's where the solar system ends.
Well, we do know that they're not there anymore. So
they're
out the far side.
Beyond.
Now, some photographs are coming back into the media as such about the moon. The photographs that were taken from, I nearly said Artemis. And the photo of the day today, was yesterday, April the 20th, and the astronauts captured a fantastic, unique image of the moon's dark side. And it's hard to recognize anything, because we just are not familiar with the dark side, because it never points to us. But we might have seen some photographs. Yep, we might have. But it's well worth a little wander around the internet to catch up, because they are readily available. And it doesn't tell us exactly what area this is, but there is a Terminator line where the sun sort of lights up the inside of craters and leaves some dark shadows and things as well. So if you're into that type of photography, which I am, I'd just love to see those particular photographs. So well worth a watch on the internet.
Thank you, John. Yes, I saw that photograph, the photograph from Apollo 8 of Earthrise, yeah. And then the Artemis 2 one of Earth Set, yeah. I believe it was. Of course, there's lots of instruments. We'll see a lot of satellites going around the Earth, measuring and keeping tabs on temperatures and wind speeds and melting ice and things like that. And apparently there's a huge difference in the planet now from when Apollo 8, when was that, 1968?
Yeah.
And that's why they called, why, in fact, I believe we got Earth Day from, which is tomorrow, actually, Wednesday the 22nd is Earth Day. And it kind of stems from that Apollo photograph.
Yeah, it's still one of those things. The quality, even in those days, was absolutely fantastic. And the newer ones from the Artemis crew are still breathtaking. Yeah,
I think it was Borman, the astronaut, who said that that he was surprised that they went all the way to the moon, and yet the most fascinating thing they saw was the Earth. Mm. You know, you see the blue and the white clouds, and whereas the moon, even though it must be great to see it up close, it's, you know, it's kind of grey and monotonous type of, well, maybe that's being unfair to the moon, saying monotonous terrain, but, you know, there's no oceans or clouds or vegetation.
Yeah.
No. So tell us about, the 12 people, only 12 people on Earth have seen.
Yeah, I did this, have it.
Solar, what was it? Annular solar eclipse. While you have it. Thank you for your text. I saw the beautiful, extremely thin crescent moon in the last two nights. Sky was so clear, I could see the rest of the moon.
Yeah.
Albeit faded, says Aaron in Tala. Thank you, Aaron, for your text. Yeah, it was a beautiful sight. I had a few comments about it from other people as well.
Yeah, I had a good couple of clear nights over the last few days as well. So, back to 12 people on Earth who saw the Ring of Fire eclipse. And here's how one improvised to capture the once-in-a-lifetime photograph from, would you believe, take away from the Artemis mission for the moment, but Antarctica is one of the areas that saw that particular, the same eclipse that the guys on the Artemis saw as well. So there was a remote team at the French-Italian Concordia Research Station. They recently experienced, and you don't need to travel beyond the moon to see the truly private eclipse. Isn't it wonderful as well? You can see things like that. So only 12 people on Earth saw this particular one, and of course it was four up in Artemis as well.
But that must have been at different times.
Yes, they were slightly different times, yes. And doesn't give me the exact time, actually.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
No, maybe it does. 70... Yeah, it was actually back in February the 17th in this year that they saw that. The Concordia team witnessed something likely seen nowhere else on Earth, and then of course Artemis had to get one better than that.
Total solar eclipse.
And they just happened to be in the right position at the right time and the right everything just to get the coronal. Although it wasn't like the one that you might have seen on your travels, where you get a very, very defined corona. But it was showing sort of a hazy type of this. It was a different vision, which is really nice to see. So there you go. So only 12 people in Antarctica, would you believe, which is down south, about 16,000 feet above sea level. So we're in trouble if the ice melts down there. Yep, we certainly are. Whereas the North Pole, it's running over water all the time. And I only thought it was quite shallow up there at one stage. Mm-hmm. It's actually up about 4,000 metres deep at the North Pole as well. So there's a lot of water on this planet.
There is, but most of it is salty water.
Yeah, well, they have these gadgets now that can... one's called the sun, which evaporates it off the sea and turns it into rainwater. Can't understand why they have to go desalination plants and things when there's plenty of rain around.
Well, they have in dry countries, say, a lot of countries in the Middle East, for example, have desalination plants.
They certainly do, yeah.
Whereas we don't need one. Although, that was when, you know, we go off piste here, but I was amused. Some people suggested instead of taking water from the Shannon, you know, that controversial idea.
Mm-hmm.
Don't see a problem with it myself, but what do I know? That a desalination plant, I think Ireland having a desalination plant. So, on the face of it, it sounds nuts to me. But anyway, let's go back to astronomy.
Yeah, let's go back to the toilet and the Artemis mission. That was before it sort of slips our mind totally. And the astronauts were saying that the space toilet doesn't deserve the bad press it got over the last past 2 weeks. According to the mission commander, Reid Wiseman, of course, and he took some time to defend Artemis II's lunar loo on Thursday, April the 16th, during a press conference in which four mission crewmates were there as well, the Victor Glover, Christina Koch, Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen, and of course himself. And he just wanted to say 100% point blank, that was a wonderful toilet. And the toilet worked great. Yep. So, there's some pictures here of Christina, I suppose, back on Earth before they were putting it into the spacecraft, making sure that she knew how to work it exactly, because she did the engineering and the toilet brush and everything.
And they're back. Yep. Happy, safe, and sound.
Happy, safe, and sound.
Flushed with success. Okay.
Can't believe it. Now, as always, we have tons and tons of things to get through.
I was interested about very briefly, because we only have about a minute and a half left, but the Artemis, the astronauts, and how their grip is affected when they go into space, when they grip things.
Yeah.
Of course, it takes the brain some time to get used to it, and because we here, us mere mortals here on Earth, we know that we have to take into account, we don't get down with pens and papers and do the maths, but we know instinctively when we're lifting up something or turning something, we take into account the force required and the gravity affects the amount of force we have to use when we want to turn a spanner or such like. But apparently when you go into space, there was a big study done on 11 astronauts before and after they went up to space. So it took them a while for the brain to retrain to get the right grip.
Mm-hmm.
You can do things too forcefully up there, put a lot more effort into it than you need to, and if you're not careful, of course, you can set something flying across the room and smash into some equipment or into your fellow astronauts, and you don't want that. And then conversely, when they came back, then it took them a while. They weren't using enough force to turn a screw or take the lid off the jar or whatever, the coffee jar.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so the saying it was it was big. Well, a big, when I say a big study, there was 11 astronauts from the European Space Agency involved, and it could affect if you either here or in space, if you use too much or too little force and something goes haywire. Sorry, I couldn't do that in a bit more detail, but that's all, because that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you for your text, and our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and thanks to John for his news items. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. It's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here, because up next we have Dublin's Greatest Hits, and then from 10 p.m. until midnight, Nigel Wood has his ear to the globe with his world music mix, and from midnight until 2 a.m. it's After Hours with Dave Barry and his mix of jazz, blues, and soul. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. And next week, we'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. And say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
broadcasting on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.